Well, good morning. If you are new with us, my name's Tim Deal. I'm one of the pastors here. And no, I don't normally have this so high because I can barely see over it. But a buddy of mine's here, and he's going to be speaking to us this morning. And he's, you'll see, a little taller than I am. But I wanted to start off just sharing for a moment. As some of you may know, my son and I just got back from a week-long kind of missions trip that we were doing in Jamaica with another family from the church here, the Davis family. It was a fantastic week, and I'm sure you'll hear more about it. You can ask me more about it at the summer party. I'd be happy to talk your ear off at it. Even better, talk to Josh, ask him about his trip. It'll be great. But I bring that up because one of the things that we did while we were there was we kind of walked. My favorite thing that we did all week was we walked into the community, this one community called Port Maria. And if you're familiar at all with Jamaica, you may have heard people talk about it, or maybe you've been there and you've experienced this. There's kind of two Jamaicas. There's the resort Jamaica, and then there's where everybody else lives, right? And where everybody else lives is, by and large, not exclusively, but by and large, incredibly poor. And so we're walking through this city, and you know this. We're walking with a local pastor who's working on building a church there in the community. And one of the things he's known for is just being a man of the people. And so he just spends time in the community, getting to know people. Every week, walks through the streets, talks to these guys. And so he's just like, "Come with me." And so we walked with him through these communities. And it was great on a number of levels. I got, you know, Josh had, I think, his first experience with people smoking weed. Multiple times, we got to have some great conversations. He's very familiar with the smell now. He can kind of notice it coming. We all can. But in one of the conversations, we walked up to this group of people who were kind of sitting there, and one guy was on his phone. And we're like, "Hey," so we're with Pastor Watson, and we're just kind of, you know, talking to people, asking how you're doing, and if there are ways we can pray for you. And he kind of glances up from his phone briefly, and he's like, "Where are you from?" And I think it's a rhetorical question, probably, because it's obvious. But we're like, "Well, we're from America, from Pennsylvania." And he just kind of looks back at his phone, and he says, "Pray for yourself. Pray for America." And at first, I was kind of like, okay, I think that's kind of a kind way of saying, "Don't bother me." And so, you know, we had a little bit more conversation, prayed for a couple other people, and kind of moved on. But then it was interesting. We got in this morning around 1:30 or so, and one of the great things about the trip was that we were offline the entire time. No contact with the outside world, no idea. The United States could have exploded, and we'd just find out when we couldn't land. And so we got back, and my phone starts blowing up from like people texting me because, you know, I'd been offline. And I start seeing comments about things like North Korea and Charlottesville. And I'm like, "What? What's going on?" And then we're watching the news ticker, you know, as we're standing there to get our bags, and we're waiting forever in customs, and we're looking at the screen, and we're just reading the news ticker, you know, talking about Charlottesville and North Korea. And I was like, "Oh my goodness, I just want to sleep. I don't want to think." But I just couldn't help thinking, like, what does this mean for us? How do we respond to this kind of thing? And I was reminded of a quote by a theologian, a guy named Karl Barth. He says, "To clasp the hands in prayer is the beginning of an uprising against the disorder of the world. To clasp the hands in prayer is the beginning of an uprising against the disorder of the world." And I thought, well, at a minimum, I think we should pray. I think we should pray individually, but I think we should pray corporately. Because when we see evidence of hatred, it's really easy for us, and we should, in many cases, talk about the hatred that exists out there and how we need to respond to it. But what we see often when we come to Scripture is that the hatred that's out there is kind of an amplified version of the hatred that's in here. It's what happens when the hatred within us is kind of carried to full term and gives birth. That's why if you're familiar with the teachings of Jesus at all, there's this place that we often refer to as the Sermon on the Mount. There's kind of three chapters in Matthew's gospel. And there's a kind of a period in there where Jesus kind of ticks off some of the Ten Commandments, kind of the famous Ten Laws that we find in the Old Testament. There's a bunch of laws, but there's kind of ten. You've probably heard of the Ten Commandments. And there's one really famous one, thou shalt not kill. Or another translation says, thou shalt not murder. And Jesus says this. He says, you have heard that our ancestors were told, you must not murder. If you commit murder, you are subject to judgment. But I say, if you are even angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. If you call someone an idiot, you are in danger of being brought before the court. And if you curse someone, you are in danger of the fires of hell. Now, on a cursory reading, it's easy to go, hoo-hoo, easy, Jesus. I mean, you're kind of taking it a little far, right? I mean, really? Calling someone an idiot? I mean, I'm sure most of us, especially when we're behind the wheel, have been guilty of that. Surely Jesus is just speaking in hyperbole. But when you experience things like what we see in situations like Charlottesville, you start to understand a little bit more about what Jesus is talking about. Because what happens when someone acts out in rage in a way that causes someone to die doesn't begin when that person wakes up in the morning and says, you know what? I think I'm going to kill someone today. You know that. It begins in the heart. It begins with the prejudices, the assumptions, the anger, the hatred, the chips on our shoulder that we allow to sink deeply into our hearts and fester and carry around for days and weeks and months and years. And eventually, that gives birth. Now, of course, in the vast majority of us, that does not give birth into murderous rage. But it does create us, it makes us into the kind of people that give birth to that ideology, that sense of lashing out at those we're afraid of, that we see as our enemy, rather than following Jesus' way of loving the enemy, offering forgiveness to those who hurt us, welcoming in the outsider and the marginalized, making space in our lives for those who are different than us. It's that heart issue that Jesus is most concerned of, because that's what gives birth to the action. And so this morning, I wanted to just take a moment and pray together for what's going on out there and for our ability to be a different kind of people in the world, but primarily for what's going on in here, in our hearts, in your heart, in my heart. For us to look really deeply at our own hearts and the places where we harbor resentment and hatred, where we are people who are quick to call the other an idiot, that we're quick to kind of use the slur, use the derogatory word. We'd never physically hurt someone. We'd never physically lash out. But what Jesus is getting at is, it's the same thing. The root of that is the same in our hearts. And if we're not quick to root it out, it could give birth to something murderous. And so I want to lead us in prayer this morning. And so I'm just going to pray with us. I'm going to give us kind of just a couple of seconds of silence for you to kind of to pray. And then I want to pray for us. And I'm going to close out reading a prayer that you may have heard of. It's been set to music. There's a lot of different ways it's been used, but it's frequently referred to as the prayer of Saint Francis. So let me lead us into prayer. We'll take just a moment, kind of quiet yourself and begin praying silently. Father, it is with a heavy heart sometimes that we read the news and we think about the way that hate gives birth to murderous rage. But it's with even a kind of a heavier heart, that I recognize the places in my own life, in my own heart, that I hold murderous thoughts, that I hold hateful thoughts towards others. Father, I ask for forgiveness for myself and for my friends, for the places where we harbor hatred towards others, towards people who are made in your image. God, would you help us to be brutally honest with ourselves today and every day? Help us to search our hearts. And Father, even more, would you search our hearts? Because we know that we don't even know ourselves half the time. We assume that we're so much more gracious and loving than we actually are, when the reality is most of us have these dark corners that we like to pretend aren't there. But we need you to dig down and to give us eyes to see the dark places in our hearts, the places where we harbor bitterness and hate and resentment towards others. And we need you to heal us, to restore us, to resurrect us from that place of hatred and move us towards reconciling love. Move us towards love that is shaped like the cross, where you give your life so that we can have life. You don't hold on to life, you don't protect yourself, but you give yourself generously so that all of us can be reconciled to God and to one another. And would you empower us as your followers to be ministers of reconciliation, to be people who are living our lives, helping others be reconciled with God and with one another and with us. Forgive us, heal us, and empower us to be agents of peace and love in our families, in our neighborhoods, at our workplaces, in our country, and around the world. And Lord, we pray the prayer of Saint Francis and ask that you would make it so in our lives. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, it is my pleasure this morning to invite a good friend of mine, John Eisenberg, to come on up. I'm going to invite John out. John was actually here a couple of years back, and John and I go way back. We've known each other for probably 15 years, maybe, a long, long time. We're that old that we can say that. John is one of those people who I just regularly have conversations with, and I'm like, oh, I need to think about that. Oh, that's really interesting. So I'm really excited for him to be here. He recently took a position with, so for years and years, we knew each other through InterVarsity Christian Fellowship and my work with that group, which is a nonprofit that works with college students. And he recently took a role as, what's your official title? Vice President of Advancement. I was going to say that. At Water Street Rescue Mission. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So he may say more about that during, so I won't steal his thunder, but I'm really excited to have John here with us. He's going to share with us this morning. And I'm also really excited that I don't have to do it, because if you don't remember, I got in at 1:30 in the morning this morning. So I'm grateful that John is here. So I'm going to pray for him, if you'll pray with me. God, thanks so much for John. Thank you for the gift he's been in my life and for the ways that you are working in him and through him in the lives of people in Lancaster and at Water Street and the ministry they have going there. God, we're grateful to be able to hear from him this morning. Would you help us to have ears to hear what you would say to us through John? And we ask this in your name. Amen. Are you turned on? Yep.
Am I on? I can't hear myself. Is that... Hello? Okay, excellent. So having stood in the back listening to Tim, I kind of feel like church is over. We just need to think about that for a while. I don't know about anyone else. So I have a number of disclaimers before I get jump into the text that Tim gave me for the morning. You know, I really, I've known Tim, as he said, for 15 years, and I know him to be a great speaker. And I wanted to come in and have a great video clip and some funny stories and do something that was going to be almost Tim-worthy, maybe even like a TED Talk. And yet, that just wasn't happening for me over the last couple weeks as I was thinking about this. I struggled to find stories. I struggled in a number of different places. And then a lot, I've been on vacation for the last 2 weeks, came home on Friday. The only contact I had with the outside world was my phone periodically. I was in the mountains. There was no cell coverage. But once in a while, I'd get cell coverage, and I'd get, hey, here's the latest way that we're on the brink of a nuclear disaster. And then I'd go back into the mountains and go fishing with my kids. And so the week was really heavy and confusing, and then there was Venezuela, and then yesterday happened. And, you know, I'm 4 months into a new job as vice president. I have two sort of tweener kids. There's no shortage of places that I feel distracted. And honestly, I think over the course of yesterday, as I was thinking about today, I felt more and more convicted about how much I wanted to have a neat, tidy, funny story with simple answers and a sense of victory. And I just don't know that I have that. I think what I have is more a willingness to share as a brother, as a fellow pilgrim, how's God working in my life, and a sense of trusting that when Tim first called me in June and said, hey, I'm going on this mission trip, I need somebody to fill in, I think you're a great person, that somehow the chaos in our world and the craziness of my job change and the vacation, God knew that was happening as he gave us Genesis 14 and he gave me the opportunity to share today. So I'm hopeful that I can be an encouragement, in part because Abraham has always been one of my heroes. When I was a college student, I was not a Christian. My dad was kind of a secular humanist, but he had grown up in an Orthodox Jewish family. And my mom was a Christian, and I was confused. And so when I was in college, I was trying to figure out what life was about and got really interested in 19th century European existentialism. Anyone else out there interested in 19th century European existentialism? Probably not. But Kierkegaard and Nietzsche are kind of the two big names in that era, and did a lot of work with Nietzsche. Nietzsche, of course, is famous for saying God is dead, but he was fascinated with this sense, with this person or this personage that would look at the culture and say, I'm not going to be conformed to the culture. I'm going to somehow break free and do my own thing. One of the stories that is highlighted if you read about Nietzsche, he really liked the composer Beethoven, and one of the reasons he liked the composer Beethoven was because there was a procession in Austria. The king was going down the street with his whole entourage, you know, picture the motorcade and the president and all that, and Beethoven just sort of walked through the middle of it, and that's kind of who Nietzsche liked. That sense, he called it Zarathustra. He liked that person that could sort of break free of the culture and just do what he wanted to do. Now, there's a downside. Nietzsche was ultimately an atheist, and so there was a lot more violence associated with that than God. But I think Abraham is, in a sense, that kind of person, because as you've probably heard, in the world where Abraham was living, there was this sense of fate and just life is a cycle, and it just repeats itself over and over. And in the midst of that, Abraham is invited to go, and instead of just staying in his town, journey towards something, towards the future. That's remarkable to me. One of the reasons that Abraham's a hero. Kierkegaard had a similar, He wrote a whole book, Fear and Trembling, about Abraham sacrificing Isaac and reflecting on what is it that's happening in that moment. Again, this picture of extreme courage. So as a college student who was kind of checking out God but wasn't really sure and was just looking for lots of meaning, Abraham got lifted up even before. And so I come back to him over and over, and I feel inspired by his story. And yet he's also a bit of a conundrum. I think we're far enough into Genesis. I don't know exactly what Tim or others have spoken on, but you know, he claims his wife is his sister and gives his wife into sexual slavery to a foreign king. That's a little weird. I don't know that I can look at that and say, hey, this dude is like the ultimate Christian guy that I want to live my life after. That's a little bit of a conundrum to me. Why does God choose this guy? And I think part of the reason I'm inspired by Abram over time is the sense of the heroic courage, but also the sense of the dude messes up, and yet God stays with him. And so I want to look at a little bit of those ideas as they play out in Genesis 14. So I will read the passage that's up on the screen, but I'd like you to maybe even close your eyes and not just listen. For me, I just said I was a philosophy guy. I like to analyze. What I found is that it's sometimes God speaks more powerfully if I try and imagine myself in the story. So maybe you want to close your eyes, or at least just try and quiet yourself and imagine yourself in chapter 14 of Genesis. At the time when Amraphel was king of Shinar, Arioch king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer king of Elam, and Tidal king of Goyim, these kings went to war against Bera king of Sodom, Birsha king of Gomorrah, Shinab king of Adma, Shemabir king of Zeboim, and king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these later kings joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is the Dead Sea Valley. For 12 years they had been subject to Chedorlaomer, but in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him went out and defeated the Rephites in Ashtoreth, Karnaim, the Zuzites in Ham, the Emites in Sheveh Kiriathaim, and the Horites in the hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran near the desert. Then they turned back and went to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and they conquered the whole territory of the Amalekites as well as the Amorites who were living in Hazazon Tamar. Then the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, marched out and drew up their battle lines in the valley of Siddim against Chedorlaomer king of Elam, Tidal king of Goyim, Amraphel king of Shinar, and Arioch king of Elasar, 4 kings against 5. Now in the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits. And when the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some of the men fell into them, and the rest fled to the hills. The 4 kings seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food. Then they went away. They also carried away Abram's nephew Lot and his possessions, since he was living in Sodom. A man who had escaped came and reported this to Abram the Hebrew. Now Abram was living near the great trees of Mamre the Amorite, a brother to Eshcol and Aner, all who were allied with Abram. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out the 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the other people. After Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him, the king of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Sheba, that is, the king's valley. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram, saying, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and praise be to the God Most High who delivered your enemies into your hand." Then Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the people and keep the goods for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "With raised hand I have sworn an oath to the Lord God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the strap of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, 'I made Abram rich.' I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belongs to the men who went with me, to Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them have their share." kind of a crazy passage with lots of names I'm sure I mispronounced and lots of places that I've never been. So I wanted to take some time to just enter into a couple different pieces of the story. First, I wanted to talk about Abraham and Lot. We all know that Lot is Abram's nephew, I'm sure. As I was trying to figure out how long have they been journeying together, I was struck. I had never noticed before that Lot looks like he started joining Abram because his dad died. So he's Lot's uncle. And they may have been in relationship for quite a long time. Lot joins Abram and his grandfather as they begin their journey towards the Promised Land. And over that journey, it appears that they've grown very wealthy together. Certainly, we know that when they escape from Egypt the first time, they receive a lot of wealth from that experience, and they have huge herds. And in chapter 13, we see them. There's fighting starting to happen between Abraham's herders and Lot's herders, and the employees are having trouble with each other. Abram comes out and says, we're a close family relationship. I don't want this to go on this way. Why don't we separate? There's just, the land won't support us. Why don't we separate? You go left and I'll go right. You go right and I'll go left. So Lot chooses beautiful farmland, and the chapter 13 describes it almost like the garden of the Lord. It's also where Sodom and Gomorrah is, but he takes his flock and goes there, and Abram goes towards Hebron. Now that sounds really friendly, but when I think about the fact that the nephew and uncle have maybe been together for decades and have traveled hundreds of miles together, what's going on that they're separating? I wonder if there's something beneath the surface there that's not just, our flocks are at odds with each other. It almost feels like some kind of family business situation or close business partnership. These guys have done well, their business is growing, but they're not making decisions well together, and they're kind of fighting with each other, but they want to remain friends. And I just wonder, what's going on between Abram and Lot, especially given that in the end, when we see Abram going to Hebron and ultimately being in Mamre, that looks like it's 40 or 50 miles away from Lot after decades of being more commingled. That's really intriguing to me. I just wonder what that relationship is. So that, we'll come back to that, but first let's look at the map of there's all these different places that are mentioned. And on the far right side of the screen, you see it mentions Elam, and that was one of the kings as the king of Elam. Kedorlaomer, I think, I don't know that I'm pronouncing that right, as I was reading some different background pieces, they suggest that the name might be kind of an approximation saying that he's a king, but he's a king tied to a specific deity. Certainly the Elamites were a very large, successful sort of major force, major empire in the Middle East for a long period of time. They were overthrown by a guy named Hammurabi. You might know Hammurabi because of his code. But all the kings that are mentioned, the king of Shinar, Elasar, Elam, and Goyim, their kingdoms basically run from Elam up the Mesopotamian Valley. So it's a large land mass for the four kings, and it's pretty far away from where the war is happening. And I think that always blows me away. Anytime I think about a large empire, I'm struck, but especially in a time when communication is hard and logistics, and just how does that work? And in the face of, the text says that for 12 years, these four kings have gone to the small little area on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. Go back, Josh. And this tiny little area has five kings, and that huge area has four kings, and the five kings are in occupation. And for 12 years, they're having to pay tribute. And in the 13th year, they rebel. And now you can bring that next slide up, Josh. And so this is a little bit closer. And the green line represents the line that the faraway kings would have used to subdue their territory, to try and put down whatever rebellion was happening. If you look at that line, I tried to plot it out on Google Maps. It's over 400 miles. So I think about, what's the technology that you're traveling to get there in the first place? But then you're battling from town to town, and you're winning every battle. I'm sure there's casualties, but you're winning your battle. You're going to the next town over and over and over. And so now the five kings, I can just picture myself, the five kings think, okay, these guys are probably tired, their supply lines are stretched thin, we don't know exactly how they're doing, let's try and stand up to them now. And they lose again. Four kings taken on by five, and they get defeated, and their possessions are being taken. And the green line continues to the north, showing how the kings are now traveling home with all the possessions of the colonies that they've come back to invade. Can you imagine being in the middle of that? What would that feel like, to be the person who's... You can't win on your home soil. I can't imagine that. So that's where, but Lot, in the midst of that, Lot is taken captive and he's being taken away. And it says, of course, that there's his women and his possessions, there's all kinds of food. Where would he be emotionally? How despondent must he be? How defeated? What's interesting, though, is that in the midst of that map, Abram is far enough away that it doesn't look like he was necessarily having to pay tribute. He might have been aware of what was going on, but it doesn't look like he was experiencing it. But if we go to the last picture, that's the closest, sort of one step closer map, Josh. Can we go to the next one? There we go. That's just zooming in a little bit more. It's not the prettiest map that I could find, but you know, it's remarkable to me. Abram, it says that Abram had his own alliance, and there's three other people, the Marmar and these brothers, that sounds like he's sort of established he's got his own little kingdom going. He's not necessarily a king, but it sounds like he's got some kind of alliance that's working well. Maybe it's a business partner. And he's got 318 men that he can send out. What does that imply about the amount of his resources? And if he and Lot were comparable partners, what does that imply about the amount of stuff that Lot has? And what does that say about the military? I'm just, again, trying to imagine myself in this situation. And now this nephew that maybe it truly was just, hey, you know, there's lots of land, you go there, I'll go here, everything's cool, we're relatives, it's all good. But maybe it wasn't, I don't know. But you've got... I can't tell, the text doesn't emphasize that, but it does say that when someone escapes and tells him your nephew's been captured, Abram's alarmed. And what stood out to me as I was thinking about today was that Abram has a choice. You immediately you see, oh, he just gathers his men and he goes out and he takes his 318 men, but he had a choice. He could have stayed. He had a pretty good life. He had lots of material possessions. He had relationships. He had this promise of God's going to give him descendants as numerous as the sand on the seashore, or countless as stars in the sky. He's waiting for that. He's done something pretty amazing to journey, and he wants to receive that promise. How is leaving where he's comfortable and entering into pursuit of an army that has just won in every town for 400 miles. How is that going to play out? Abram has a choice. Is he going to sort of protect himself? Or is he going to go and say, you know, this is a guy he's in jeopardy, and these people are in jeopardy, and I have to do something. I have to respond. One of the things that strikes me when I think about what's that choice that Abraham makes? Of course, Abraham makes the choice. He's going to go. He takes his men. They attack. In that moment, though, it feels like it foreshadows Jesus. When we were yet sinners, Jesus doesn't just stay in heaven with his Father and the Holy Spirit. He doesn't just sit there and say, "Oh, I've got it all together," and it's too bad that those people made those choices. He goes and he says, he comes to us. He takes the risk to come to us and to set us free, to ransom the captive. And that's what Abraham's doing. Abraham's foreshadowing Jesus. He's coming and he's saying, there's people that are captive here. There's my family is captive, but I don't want to get too lost in, I don't want to get too lost in exactly the family relationship. He sees the captive, he sees the invading army, and he says, I have to engage. And he sends his men. And they amazingly, it works out. But 318 men against soldiers that have traveled all this distance, implicit in that choice is maybe the whole descendant thing isn't going to work out. Or is the descendant thing happening through Lot because it's not going to happen through me because I'm getting older and it's not happening? Like, he's risking this promise that he's been chasing for decades to try and deliver Lot. Of course, later in the New Testament, we see Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. So I also thought about how this passage redefines righteousness for me. Righteousness isn't necessarily staying safe and doing good and avoiding bad. That's I think I want that, and I think that's some of the simple, fun stories that I was talking about earlier. But it's not what happens here. Abraham believed God, and part of believing God was he saw a problem, and he saw people in captivity, and he engaged. He trusted that somehow the promise was still going to work, even if he went out and fought and engaged to try and get his nephew back. He took a crazy risk to love another person. And that's credited to him as righteousness. So that's a lot of why he's my hero. But I set that all up to say to us, you know, he's promised to have descendants as numerous as the stars, as countless as the sand. Josh, if you go to the next slide, the question I want us to think about is, will we be Abraham's descendants? Do we believe God and act the way that Abram does? Do we see people in captivity? Maybe it's immediate family members, maybe it's neighbors, maybe it's coworkers. Certainly there's lots of evidence in the world. But I think sometimes more local is more challenging. How do we respond? Do we act like Abram? Do we figure out what resources we have and we go and we press out and we figure out how do we set people free from their captivity? Or do we kind of just want to hang out with the people like us and enjoy the things that we have? Be thankful. Now, I say that not so much at you as to explain the last year of my life, year and a half of my life. Every 3 years, InterVarsity hosts a conference called Urbana. We gather about 16,000 college students and people in their mid-20s to think about what is God doing in the world and what is your place in it. And while I was at Urbana 15, there was a focus on the persecuted church, and I felt really moved by what am I doing on behalf of the persecuted church? What am I doing on behalf of people at the margin? I was a major gift officer for InterVarsity. I was doing well. And yet the last morning of Urbana, there was a Bible study, Joseph of Arimathea and the empty tomb, and the question came up in the study that I was in, How are you using your access to people of influence or your affluence to proclaim the gospel? Because Joseph does that. He has access to Pilate and he has access to the religious leaders. And if he doesn't get Jesus' body and put it in a tomb, we don't have confirmation of the crucifixion and resurrection. So he plays an instrumental role. How are we using access to influence and affluence to confirm the resurrection, to proclaim the gospel? And so I left Urbana feeling like maybe I need to rethink my job. Maybe I need to rethink where I'm called on behalf of people on the margin or on behalf of people that are persecuted and how I'm using my access. So I was pondering that, but I liked my job and I was well regarded. And so I waited a couple months. And in March, kind of out of the blue, a friend called me up, or someone I kind of knew called me up and said, you know, I'd like to hire you to come work with me. And as we talked about it, it felt like it could be exactly what was happening in Urbana. But I'm a guy that wants lots of communal input. That's part of why Tim and I talk so much, because I'm always going to him to figure out what God's saying to me. And as I'm processing that, I decide, you know, there's this guy in Lancaster that I haven't talked to in 20 years, and we don't really have a relationship, but I kind of feel like I should ask him what he thinks about this job opportunity. So I go to Jack, and I set up a meeting, and Jack's the president of Water Street, and as I'm pulling out of my driveway, sort of half-heartedly praying, God, how should I talk about this with Jack? We barely know each other. I felt like God said to me, are you willing to hold more people in your heart? Are you willing to expand your capacity to receive my love by loving those around you? Perhaps even people that are different than you. So I'm like, okay, that's kind of interesting. I don't really know what to do with that. And I sit down for what I thought was going to be 15 minutes of Jack's time asking him a simple question, and it turned into a two-hour conversation that ended with, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you if you wanted to be vice president of advancement. Our guy's retiring. And I was honored, but I kind of blew it off. I was like, no, that's not me. I'm flattered, but it's too small. It's too local. There's all these things. Like, I don't feel, this isn't me. This isn't my people. So that's in April of 2016. So there's still this, in the back of my mind, this sense of maybe something new is coming. And I actually was being approached by a number of different people and organizations about different job opportunities. And finally in October, last October, I went on a silent retreat at the Jesuit Center here in Wernersville. And at the end of 3 days of silence, I had this very clear sense of God asking me, what are you waiting for? And I didn't know what to do with what are you waiting for. But I was kind of prompted again. I got home at around dinner time on a Friday, and the first thing I did was send an email to Jack asking if we could have lunch. And I didn't really even know why. I just sort of reached out and felt like I wanted to talk to him again. And lo and behold, he had told me he was going to go forward with the hiring process, and he hadn't hired anyone, and so he still wanted to talk to me, and I still wasn't that interested. There was all these reasons that it wasn't really the right fit. I had a range of options. There was a secular university that wanted me to come work for them. There was an international ministry that wanted to come work for me, for them. They felt like my people. They felt like the people I was more comfortable with. You know, I'm my dad's a professor. I thought I was going to be a professor. I'm into 19th century European existentialism. You know, it's rescue mission. That doesn't sound like my people. I'm not sure. So I said no, and I kept waiting. But then in December, last December, I felt really disturbed. And this isn't, like, I'm not making a political statement. I'm not saying one side or the other. I'm just saying that the tenor of the conversation, the spirit of the conversation, left me disillusioned. I didn't see people saying, here's problems, and here's how we work across different viewpoints for the common good. In fact, because of my work as a major gift officer and some of the connections that I had through work, I had run into quite the opposite. I had been invited to a party that was a Let's Retire the President party, where it was specifically looking at how do we use Facebook and Twitter and social media to swing these sort of 18 to 25-year-old ethnic minority people in these key districts, that if we can swing that vote in this district, we can win the election. All about me and power. That doesn't sound like what I was thinking this was all about. And I was wrestling with that. And then I read a story about how people with lots of money on both sides of the aisle were spending crazy amounts of money developing tools on Facebook that would sort of systematically move you one way or another. And you wouldn't even realize you were being moved. It was just the way advertising was going to work. They would develop these psychographic profiles and figure out who you were. If you liked 150 things, they could put you into a pigeonhole and then systematically start pushing ads at you to try and shape your worldview. And I was disillusioned. It wasn't about a particular political party, because I heard it on both sides. I started wondering, can you really engage nationally? Can change really happen at a national level? Or maybe the reason there's all this vitriol is because when you go national, you don't know the person. You don't know who to trust. There isn't a face-to-face relationship. And I started feeling like God was saying I needed to focus locally. And then I discovered the captivity in Lancaster. As I was willing to not just read BBC and not just read international news and news from big cities, I started reading about what was going on in Lancaster, and I discovered that in Lancaster, 29% of the population lives in poverty. That's more than Philadelphia or Detroit, which are the highest poverty levels in the United States. 40% of kids in Lancaster, 40% of the poor in Lancaster are under 18. 80% of the school district gets government subsidies because they're in 125% of the poverty line. Oh my gosh. How am I using my access to people of influence and affluence on behalf of people on the margin? Can I go national? Maybe I need to go really local. And so I went back to Jack and I said, well, if the position's still open, maybe we need to talk about this. And I had sort of in the back of my mind over the last 10 years, God's been developing a vision in me of what is shalom, what does God's peace look like? And that it doesn't mean the absence of social strata, that it just means the absence of oppression. And that happens because the people at the bottom have a message of hope, much like Abraham had a message of hope. But the people at the top have an understanding of how they're thankful for what they have and they use it on behalf of others. They don't just use it on themselves. And I was thinking about that and I'm wondering, well, maybe there's something in that. And so I asked Jack, what's the job? Do you just need somebody to fill in the place that's retiring, or what do you really want to do? And he gave me a picture of not just raising money for Water Street, but really trying to change the conversation about poverty and homelessness and help people understand why that's happening. And so I felt like, oh, maybe this is it. And then the voice in the back of my head switched to, but it's a pay cut and it's career suicide. InterVarsity is one of the 400 largest nonprofits in the country, and I'm on the verge of getting a promotion. In fact, I was offered a promotion that I turned down to move into leadership of the 2.0 version of InterVarsity's development program, which I basically started 10 years ago. And so but it's a pay cut, and these are my people. These are the people that resonate with the ideas, and I'm confronted with this choice. Do I chase after a problem that feels huge and is really scary, and it's people that are really different than me, or do I stay in my comfortable job with travel perks and lots of esteem from people that I like? And it feels a lot like what Abraham was facing when he hears the news that Lot's in captivity and being dragged away. So I lean in. I tell Jack, I'll get back to you in January. And in January this year, InterVarsity had a national conference. It's every 3 years. It's the only time they gather all 1,600 staff in one place. And it's that kind of typical, you know, I don't know if all jobs have this, but a lot of companies will have some kind of gathering that's the rah-rah meeting. You know, it's like, oh, aren't we great? This is so awesome. I love being here. And so I'm going in thinking this is InterVarsity's chance to convince me that I'm going to stay, that this is the right place for me to be. And with every plenary talk over the 4 days, it was clearer and clearer. First day, what's the big dream God's giving you that exposes you to the extraordinary power of God? So that's a question to you. What's the big dream that God's giving you that exposes you to the power of God when you're confronted with this kind of choice? Next day, you know, having this kind of vision is a blessing and a burden. It's not easy to be an innovator or the one that brings something into existence. And continues a little bit later in the same talk. Someone in this room, now I'm not necessarily, you know, I go to a Presbyterian church, I'm open to the Holy Spirit, but I'm not like a charismatic guy. I don't really think of God speaking to people specifically in a meeting. But the person says, but this is more of a Pentecostal preacher that's doing the plenary talk, and she says, someone sitting in this room sits in boardrooms and thinks to yourself, why are you here? And then she goes on to say something that I say regularly. Okay, this is a little creepy. And then the next day, what does the world, what does your neighbor need from God right now, and how can you be part of it? And this was the part that was, I think, the most compelling to me. The hardest, but the thing that pushed me over the edge. And so I wanted to share it with you. We don't need optimism. What we need is a massive leap of faith into the confusion and complexity. We need a willingness to look for God to show up as you do something crazy to love someone you might not even know. So in the midst of Abraham having this choice where he might have had some major fight with Lot. We don't know what's going on. But when he hears that Lot is being dragged into captivity, he has this choice. Do I stay and enjoy my life and the promises that God's given to me and wait for the promises? Or do I take a risk and go and challenge try and set Lot free? That's kind of how I feel like that's my life for the last 18 months. And I wanted to share that to say, what's your story? Are you going to be Abraham's descendant? How do you need to be engaged in this? And it may not be a big job change. I think there's times when moving far away or thinking about the new job is actually the escape. That's harder than staying with the people that you already know, that already know you, and trying to do something different. So maybe there's a family member, or maybe there's someone in your neighborhood or a coworker that's trapped. They're in some kind of captivity. They're being dragged down the wrong direction. What's something you can do to be like Abram, to be Abram's descendant who sets the captive free, to be the Jesus follower who ransoms the captive? I'm going to give you a minute to think about that, and then I want to come back to the text for the final story about Melchizedek and King Sodom. But why don't you take just a second? Is there some specific, it doesn't have to be earth-shattering, big, major life change, but is there some specific thing that comes to mind right now of how you can love someone? Take a risk. Let's just take 30 seconds. Well, I encourage you, since you have a picnic coming up, that might be a great, maybe not your typical church picnic conversation, but that might be a great opportunity to get some people to hold you accountable and help you step into it, as Tim has done for me over the last year and a half of being in that journey with me. But I wanted to just briefly talk about Melchizedek and the king of Sodom, because it's a really interesting exchange that happens. Melchizedek comes and finds Abram and blesses him on behalf of God, and Abraham responds by doing something crazy, giving 10%. This is the first time the tithe shows up in the text. And I'm a development officer, so I could go on for a long time about how the tithe is really important. That's not my point. My point is that Abram's really focused on receiving blessing from God, and when he receives blessing from God, it overflows in more risk-taking. It overflows in more in this crazy act of generosity. Immediately after that, the next thing that happens in Genesis 14 is that the king of Sodom comes and finds him and says, you give me the people back and I'll give you all this stuff. I just want my people back. I need my kingdom back. And that kind of sounds like maybe it's Abram, because maybe the king really loves these people, but maybe he doesn't. I don't know. But Abram's response is really striking. I don't want anyone to say that I got rich from you, because this is from God. So as you're thinking about this choice, and how do you see the people that are in captivity, and how does your righteousness extend into delivering them? It's about receiving something profound. It's having that Melchizedek moment where God shows up and says, you are blessed by God Most High, creator of the universe. It's going to be tempting to think that it's about what people say to you, but it's not. You got to resist that. I think that's why that story's in that. And you just stay focused on that encounter with God, believing God, loving as God does, letting God fill you with his love and expand your capacity for his love. So I hope that's an encouragement to you as you think about going into this next week, especially with all the craziness that's happening nationally and internationally. May you risk on behalf of the other of people around you and have a holy moment as Abram has a holy moment.
Right. Well, we're gonna wrap things up soon, and we're gonna finish with the final song, and then move into our summer party. But before we do, I had asked John, because we typically do a Q&A at the end, and John felt a little uncomfortable with just like throwing it out, because you guys can be pretty tough. So I said I'd lob them some softballs. But I wanted to just throw like one or two questions. And the first one I was thinking of, John, for most of us, we're not looking for a job opportunity to live this out, right? You mentioned that. When you talk about taking risks to love people next to us, you know, many of us, honestly, we're just trying to keep it together day in, day out. You know what it's
so
like. You have two kids, a mortgage, you know, grocery shopping, all the unsexy stuff that makes life life. What does that mean for the majority of us who aren't going to work for a rescue mission? What does taking risks to love the person next to us look like? And obviously that you can't give an exhaustive list, but any thoughts when you think about that of ways that we can begin to kind of move in that direction?
I have two things quickly coming to mind. One actually just happened yesterday morning. So we used to live right near Franklin and Marshall College, and there was it's really bad bagels, but the kids think of it as this great experience. We would walk down the street to this bagel store on the corner of campus and have bagels, and then I would take them to school. And they really wanted to go for breakfast yesterday. So we went, and as we walk in, I'm just thinking about it's the last day of my vacation, and I want to enjoy this time with my kids, and we're going to have breakfast, and it's this memory, and isn't this awesome? And we sit down, and at the table immediately next to us is this guy that I'm looking at him, and I'm like, that guy's homeless. There's no question in my mind that's a homeless guy that's been allowed to have space in this bagel store. He's got sort of the wrong clothes on for the season of the year. He's got several bags, none of which are matched in any way. I mean, just everything about him. This guy is not, he's not just journeying. He's got four cards in front of him. It kind of looks like he's playing solitaire, but I realized he had four aces, and he just stared at them the entire time we had a meal. So we're getting up to leave, and my kids turn to me, and they say, Dad, what was going on with that guy? I said, well, I'm pretty sure he was a homeless guy. Dad, is Water Street full? No, we have empty beds. Dad, why didn't you talk to him? Why didn't you get him a home? Why didn't you, like, you're supposed to be about restored to be restorers. So, guilty as charged. I mean, the kids are completely convicting. So I think one of them is just, it doesn't have to be the life-shattering thing. Like, it's just being aware of who's around you and what seems to be going on. Another funny story in that same vein. I was on my way to an important meeting with a Wall Street executive, and this is, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. And as I'm walking down the street, I see a guy who's bleeding profusely from the top of his head. And it's clear that the guy needs help. But I'm a good... I crossed on the other side. I just went to my meeting. And I felt... You know, it doesn't have to be earth-shattering. It's the... are you willing to have your eyes open and let your day be interrupted a little bit? I've taped a note on my bathroom mirror that says, love trumps efficiency, to try and remind myself every day to just look for that sort of act of love. Just to give a neighborhood example, there was a crazy thing that happened 2 years ago. Where I live in Lancaster, I live next door to the worship pastor of Calvary, which is sort of a large church in Lancaster, and I live on a cul-de-sac, and there pretty much everybody on my cul-de-sac goes to Calvary. And that's a weird experience for me in itself, because when I lived next to F&M, all my neighbors were professors that were atheists, and so I'm trying to get used to living in the midst of this Christian cul-de-sac, except for one house that's a Jewish couple. And she's from Israel Jewish. She's like the real deal. And she's pretty progressive when she comes to her Judaism. She's completely fed up with how Calvary messes up the road. Like, she can't drive into town on a Sunday because Calvary destroys the traffic, and she feels like that's an affront to her freedom. I mean, this is just giving you a sense of who she is. And it was when the whole Chick-fil-A and LGBT stuff happened, and someone posted something on Facebook. But of course, we're all friends, so we're all Facebook friends, and so this post goes on Facebook, and it blows up. And she knows that I've got Jewish family, and we had kind of connected around a little bit of Jewish heritage, and she confides in me how offended she is by the cul-de-sac. So what do I do to go to my neighbors? That I have a 30-year mortgage. They have a 30-year mortgage. We're probably going to be there a while. Do I take a risk and actually talk to them about, hey, you know, the witness of who Jesus is really problematic for this woman, and you're pushing her away. And I think the scripture makes it clear that if you're pushing people away from Jesus, it doesn't end well for you. So just taking some of those risks in your immediate circumstance.
Well, and that was, so my final question, and then we'll move into the final song here, is, you know, for a lot of us, the poverty that exists around us, because of where we live, the poverty that exists around us may not be financial poverty. So any suggestions for those of us who, I mean, yes, we all need to pay attention to those who are struggling financially, who are on the margins. Any thoughts for those of us who also need to take some risks on behalf of our affluent neighbors who are struggling with maybe different kinds of poverty? What might that look like?
I saw a really convicting video, and I'm a news junkie. I don't remember where I saw this, but it was a video about, it was this 18-year-old beautiful cheerleader who had a 4.0 that was a heroin addict. and it just really grabbed me. I think the reality is, I spent most of the last 10 years working with people that are certainly the 1%. My focus in InterVarsity was people that could give $100,000 or more. And all of them are broken. And I don't say that in a judgmental way. One of the guys that was most striking to me, partner at Goldman Sachs, had achieved everything. He realized he didn't feel like he had close friends, so he decided to invite friends over to his house on Friday mornings and they'd have bagels together. Just to be clear, it was in his living room, it was 150 people. Just think about that for a second. But when you meet him, he's the first thing he'll say to you is that he has all the success, and he lives in New Canaan, and it's all the trappings of everything that's the American dream. And he's an alcoholic, and he's estranged from his wife, and he's estranged from his kids. I'm pretty convinced that there's something I call it affluence guilt. That there's people feel guilty for all that they have, and they get trapped by that, and they get isolated by that. So I don't know that I have a real concrete example in quite the same way, except to say, you think that it's this person over here that has needs, but I mean, my story of living in the cul-de-sac in some ways is the story. I've become the suburban, I moved to Manheim Township because it's the best schools, and one of my kids have the best schools, and I could live the suburban life that pulls into my driveway and has my family life and takes the kids to all the soccer tournaments, or I could think about actually going next door and meeting Mike and meeting John and meeting Mary and meeting Vicky and getting to know their story. And as I've done that, I find out, there's brokenness there.